Hello and welcome to episode 6 of WB40. This week, Chris and I are discussing the economics of cloud. So welcome back. Good to be with you again. Chris, how's your week been?
I've had a very busy week, Matt. It's been here, there and everywhere. And I'm just glad that we're back and doing another one of these. It makes it all worthwhile.
You actually managed to get a visit into my hometown in the last 7 days, which is lucky I wasn't here.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm starting to think they were avoiding me. But no, I was there. I was judging on a pitch day from some startups, which was really interesting, actually. What you'd expect to see, kind of mixture of the wacky and the well-trodden. And that's exactly what it was. We had people with some fairly outlandish drone technology, which was interesting, and then some of the more standard IoT exploitation as well. So an interesting day in Teddington.
Fantastic. And what was the startup that won the day?
Well, there were a number that won the day, and I'm not allowed to divulge their names right now because it's still under embargo. But it was around the social housing sector, so there were a number that got through onto this accelerator that I was working for.
Fantastic! Sounds like good fun.
Yeah, it was.
So this week, on the back of a blog article that I wrote last week, we're going to explore something around the economics of cloud computing. And just thinking about how both consumer organisations of technology and also suppliers need to start thinking about how their business models change as a result of the increasing adoption of cloud computing. Now, the move to cloud has been something that's been happening over the last 10 to 15 years, I guess, in one form or another. But I think in the last couple of years, we've moved into a realm now where it's seen as a standard way of doing things as opposed to something that's a bit out of air and wacky. But I think that we're still only just starting to scratch the surface of the way in which organisations consume technology, how they budget for it, and the way in which they think about having relationships with their suppliers. Now, thrust of the argument in the article that I wrote was that one of the central truths within business technology is the idea of one system. So rather than having multiple systems supporting the same business function, you should consolidate everything down to a single system, and that will give you economy of scale. And my view on this at the moment is I don't know whether that still applies within the world of particularly software as a service, where you're buying an entire service end to end without having to worry about any of the infrastructure to be able to manage it. And I guess the central theme of my argument is in the world of where you had to manage servers yourself, so the physical infrastructure to run an accounting system or a HR system, actually, one of your biggest costs was just the feeding and watering of the servers, the server room, the air conditioning, the fire control systems, the security control systems, the operating systems, the databases, and then your application that would sit on top of that. And with all that cost, if you were duplicating all of that by having multiple, say, I don't know, 3 or 4 different HR systems, you could make significant cost savings by consolidating down into one product. And you also had the opportunity to be able to reduce down integration costs because you were having a single system being able to do the same function across the organisation. And so there's some big benefits to be had from consolidating everything down onto a single platform. The downside of it was that if you have one single piece of software to support the same function across a big organisation, you end up probably with something that doesn't suit everybody's needs particularly well and runs the risk of actually supporting nobody's needs. And if you look at the prevalence of how much still is done in spreadsheets across every big organisation, I think that's the evidence of the downside from a user needs, user experience and business needs perspective. But because you had massive great cost savings by consolidating out on server rooms, it was still worthwhile. Does that sound like a fairly fair assessment of the way in which the on-premise world works?
It is, absolutely. I think That's it's a fair summary. I think where a lot of companies struggle is with the idea that you move to cloud, and what you get with cloud is you get best practice management of servers, best practice backup and recovery, which is all brilliant, but you do pay for it. And I think there's a strange what's the word I'm looking for? There's the you move from when you start a business and you say, okay, we're gonna kick this off, and we can kick off SQL servers and web servers, and we can kick off application servers in the cloud. And that's all brilliant because you've got a very low level of risk. You don't have to invest in that, and you can spin it all up in the cloud. As you get to small business size, actually most small businesses, certainly before cloud came along in its current state, would run their IT, but they'd run it on a shoestring. There'd be one or two people managing everything. They'd do their patching when they could do their patching. They'd do their backups pretty much as best they could, but you would never be entirely sure that your backups were readable or current. Things were, you do things on a shoestring, and you do things the best you could, and you do that because you needed to keep those costs down. And I think on that continuum of when you use cloud, it probably makes sense for a very small business, doesn't make sense for a small to medium business, and then starts to make sense again for a larger business, which then would do all those things that you were talking about, Matt, and have to employ all of the security people and the infrastructure people and the SQL people and the Exchange people. All of those things suddenly become more sensible to move all of those things to cloud providers than it does when you actually don't have all those people and you just get by.
So in that world, that all made sense, and the idea of consolidating through made sense. And yeah, absolutely, it's a different sort of scale of organization. There was definitely different costs involved. And I think you looked at things like the Microsoft Small Business Server, which was a single server that you could run basically all of the things you needed to be able to do a small scale business. And that in the pre-cloud era made perfect sense. That's the sort of thing that would go under a desk somewhere in an office of 20 people. For that size of organization, though, these days you'd be using Office 365, you'd be using Google Drive, you wouldn't touch building that if you were setting up a business from scratch today. And that middle bit where you start to become a bit bigger, so you've got some resource to be able to manage it, but not enough to be able to have it as great expense. There's definitely difficult transition phases when it comes to managing technology. I think actually that's a broader thing, actually, that gap between about a dozen people and about 100 people, where you need to start to put process in, but nobody can see the point of it. And that affects across a whole bunch of things, not just technology, but things like, how you manage people, about how you go about managing projects, all of those kind of areas as well. What I think is changing now with larger organizations is this fundamental truth within IT that you should put everything into a single system. And the logic behind my argument is this. The first thing is, any piece of software that is useful will lock you in. You won't be able to easily get out of it, because if it's useful to you, you don't want to move. The problem with being locked in is that if you're locked in, your supplier can take the piss, basically. They can charge you what they want until it becomes so painful that you eventually are pushed to move. But for the most part, the risk there for the client is that you end up in a position where you can't negotiate. It has to be said that some software suppliers do actively try to find other ways of locking people in, like selling ancillary products to make the whole infrastructure look on the face of it to be cheaper because you're not having to integrate, but actually becomes much more expensive because you have a single supplier that you can never get out of. But the other side of this is that in a cloud world, the cost to the supplier of every individual user is real. In the way that when you were just buying software licenses from the likes of Microsoft or Oracle or SAP or whoever else, a software license costs nothing effectively for a software vendor to be able to sell an additional one. I can sell you one user, I can sell you 100 users, I can sell you 100,000 users, and the incremental cost to my business, other than in some cost of sale, is basically zero, because I'm just selling you a notional piece of intellectual property right. if I'm selling you 100 or 100,000 users on a cloud-based service and I'm managing that service for you, the number of users you have has a material impact on the resources and the raw materials that I must provide, because I've got to be able to provide compute power to be able to support the number of users that you're using from me. And moreover, actually, there's a greater imperative now for me to drive usage, because if you're not seeing usage, then you'll look at the number of people you've got subscribing each year and you'll say, we don't need as many as that, because those people just aren't using it. In that world, I'm not sure that the economies of scale from buying more and more licenses to have everybody on a single system will be there anymore. Also, with software as a service, we have better ability to be able to integrate, theoretically, through things like RESTful APIs, so the ability to be able to get information and transactions out of systems in real time using established protocols around things like XML. It should be theoretically easier to be able to get a data out, because a prerequisite of software as a service has been that companies have been unwilling to put their data into public cloud services without guarantees they can get it out again. And so data is a lot more exportable out of cloud services than it ever was from on-premise services. And so actually, would it be better now to be able to have multiple products supporting, I don't know, an HR function across a big global organisation? Because that will keep competition in the market. If you're buying from Oracle and Microsoft and Salesforce and whoever else, if you're buying from all of them, you've got price competition built into the way in which you're consuming stuff, which if you consolidate all onto one vendor, you just don't get. And the more you've consolidated onto one vendor, the less likely it is you're ever going to move. Bearing in mind that any piece of software that is useful is going to be naturally locking you in. Now, I'm not an economist, I'll just make that very clear. But it seems to me that the nature of what we are purchasing with software as a service is very, very different from what we used to purchase with licenses. And that fundamental IT truth underpinning it, one system, is something that was predicated on the old world. And I just don't know that it exists in this new world.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think what you're saying is in theory possible, and in theory is a good thing. I think in practice, part of the reason that hasn't happened is that if you use a piece of software from one organization, in the past what you've really done is you've bought into their data model, you've bought into their process model. So as we always used to say to organizations, stop trying to get this software to follow your processes, change your processes to match the software. So you kind of build yourself around that, and you build your reporting and you manage your business through the metrics that are available through the way that software works, which you have selected because it is closest to your needs. To get to where you describe, where you're actually using individual pieces of software because they most fit your needs, but they're exchanging data through an API layer. What I think you need to do is to work on your business data model first and foremost, and understand what it is about your data and about your business that you need to record, process, report. What do your customers need to know to know that you're doing a good job for them? What do you need to know to make sure you're managing that properly? What do your supply chain need to know? You need to define all that and then build that service layer so that other software can interact with it. If you do that, then I think you've got a chance to do that. But it is quite a big effort. It's quite a big ask. It's quite a big ask technologically and conceptually for a lot of businesses. But I've seen, I had a conversation today actually with a guy who I used to work with, and he's working for a company now who I've never worked for them, but all of the problems he was telling me about, and he works on the business side rather than the IT side, but because I'm from IT, he was complaining about his IT to me. There's a shoulder to cry on. And there they are, a business with big, big contracts, small margins, and a piece of software running it all, which is just not fit for purpose, but it's It's been invested in. It's there. They've put millions and millions of pounds into it, getting it configured to do what they want to do. But what they really need to do is to take a step back and think about how they what they want. You know, when I asked him about his contract reviews, I said, I bet they're still done all done on a spreadsheet, aren't they? They're not from this system. No, they're all done on a spreadsheet. So actually, that software really isn't doing all the things that that business wanted it to do. But the decision to move back, analyze your business, understand your data model, and change it around is such a big one. Requires such a massive amount of justification, especially in a bigger organization with the board of directors who are sitting around. None of them wants to be the one that says, "Oh, do you know what? We got that one wrong. We need to pivot." And actually, a business of that size probably doesn't have the capability to pivot. So is probably stuck in its way until it breaks up and becomes, you know, it's a small entity, I guess, or dies completely. I'm not entirely sure there is a way to pivot a business, you know, a massive business of that size. So yeah, I absolutely see where you're coming from, but I think it is really difficult for large businesses to take that decision.
It's interesting though, because you talked about how, you know, you need to be able to create the data model, understand what your data is. I actually think that's a prerequisite whether you're buying one system or buying 50. And buying pre-packaged software without understanding what your organization means by the information that it carries is a recipe for the implementation of a system where every part of the business uses the same field in a different way. And if you go
It's
into any,
common, though, isn't it?
oh no, absolutely, it's horrendously common. You know, if you go into most organizations and you ask, okay, something really simple, let's say, what does a product mean? If you go to the sales team, they'll have one definition of product. If you go to your operations team, they'll have another definition of product. If you go to your procurement team, they'll mean something completely different. If you go to your finance team, they'll have probably another six or seven definitions of it, and they're all different and they're all right. And that kind of data modeling, which is, I think, just such an underrated skill and capability in most organizations, and I've seen very rarely being used to any level of discipline, is a prerequisite of buying software. It's not something about whether you're doing cloud or on-premise. It's not whether you're doing single system or not. It's, you just need to do that.
Well, I know you do need to do it, man, but as you say, you go into organizations that have had a big piece of software for a while, and people just learn to find ways to make it do what they need to do. And you'll say, look, please don't use telephone number three to store the dog's name. You know, that's not what we should do with this CRM system, but they do because they need to find a way to store that information. So people will always manipulate and change the way systems are designed to fit the way they work. It's like that picture that's on LinkedIn every 3 weeks about, you know, the people walking across the grass and not using the path. You know, the difference between design and use. It's that does happen. Does happen.
And that also, though, then puts pay to this idea that when you buy a piece of prepackaged software, you're buying processes. Actually, if you go to look at SAP's website, or if you go to look at Oracle's website, if you go to look at Salesforce's website, or PeopleSoft, or just Oracle, isn't it? Or Workday, or whoever else, and you actually look for the business processes, you won't find them, because that's not what you're buying. What you're buying is a set of software that has been configured to be able to provide service to support the most commonly used business processes that exist within finance or HR or wherever else. It doesn't support. It doesn't give you the mechanism to be able to run your business, and you still need to make those decisions, and then you find that nobody follows it anyway. If that's all the case, far better then surely to be able to keep autonomy down to smaller units so that they're able to be able to make decisions about what software they want to use, that they're likely to actually use it, rather than taking control away from any particular group, putting it into a central thing that nobody can actually control, and therefore everybody's using spreadsheets on the side to make actually their jobs happen.
Yeah, maybe that talks to business design as much as it does to technology selection. You know what I mean? You make your business into people size chunks rather than have a giant monolith of business, and then give it to people size of software. Why, you know, why not manage your business in that way? And again, it's the easy thing to say. It's not necessarily that easy to do in a large organization. But I think there are good models where people have kept businesses at a certain size where the complexity doesn't get too much for one person to understand it.
So let's have a think then about the way in which cloud offers new opportunity for being able to create technology within organizations. So one of the things that came out of the recent US election, of a moment of light jollity and amusement, was the fact that on the evening of DJT's victory, the Canadian immigration website crashed, which is a kind of classic example of what has been said for years to be the archetypal use case, one of the archetypal use cases for cloud computing, which is the idea of being able to have unfettered access to computing power on demand to be able to scale up when you have big moments of peak load. And so something like an election or some sort of large news event, news information sites, the Guardian or the BBC or whoever, dealing with these massive peak loads, which if you had the infrastructure to support your peak at all times, you'd be seriously overtooled, and you'd have a big cost issue on your hands. And this has been said for ages to be one of the ways in which cloud computing gives advantage. The other one, or another one, is the ability to be able to get up and running with a new idea and get it out to market at medium scale very quickly without having to worry about investment in new infrastructure. And undoubtedly, that's been one of the things that has been a driver of a lot of the development in web and in apps over the last 7, 8, 9 years, because startups haven't had to worry about getting big capital investment to get their servers up and running before they could do anything. If you look back to the first dot-com boom and bust in the late 90s, all of the money was being spent on being able to put in server farms before anything else could happen. And that's been a really marked difference this time around. And I think it has been a big success for cloud computing and the ability to get compute on demand. But 10 years in nearly to this kind of way of working, and still a big institution like the Canadian government isn't getting it right. And this isn't a one-off case at all. Let's not hold Canada solely in the sights of not being able to architect web solutions properly. You see this really frequently. Websites going down is still a big problem with demand, and not just because of, you know, malicious attacks or whatever.
Yeah, you see it at Christmas, don't you? Every year we have the which big company websites are gonna fall under the strain of Black Friday or Christmas shopping, and when that happens, that, you know, because the Christmas time is such an important retail time, that it's the end of the career for the CIO and sometimes for the chief exec. If a big retail site goes down, and we had this, I think Argos and Currys had problems last year. But I've seen it done well. I've certainly heard that the story of something like Children in Need, who, of course, they only need their capacity once a year, and Comic Relief only once every 2 years. But they work with their cloud providers, and they have very, very scalable models, which really works for them, because, of course, they're not only do they need to scale at those times massively, they also haven't got very much money because they're charities. So it can be done, but you really have to work on your model. You really have to be on top of exactly what's going to happen at that time, and work on all of the potential peaks that might come, and understand when they're going to happen.
Those peak use cases, though, are quite common within businesses as well. You look at the cycles that you get of financial reporting periods, or of sales periods, or of performance management periods. And I mean, the number of times over the years that I've seen performance management systems straining under the demand of everybody trying to get their appraisals in at the last minute because they haven't quite got round to it, which is just, you know, just the way this sort of stuff goes. There's plenty of opportunity for that kind of way of working. But it strikes me as well, it's still quite hard to do this stuff, because actually the models that are still most commonly being used are virtualized servers, and that actually platform as a service, you're starting to see some significant move in this now, but if you look at the skill sets within the average corporate IT department, they still got their heads around the idea of, well, we've got a server and then we've got a virtual server, and so we'll build everything in a way that is architected as it would have been in the server room. But and that has a set of problems with it, most notably that if you're managing just virtual servers, you've got all of the considerations that you used to have about scaling, like number of CPUs and amount of memory and amount of disk space, which you still have to tinker around with manually, which quite frankly seems really, really quite archaic in 2016 and beyond, but is still a big challenge if you're architecting your systems in that way.
Anyway, short-termism, though, I think it's much more difficult to transition a set of software and infrastructure into what you might call Azure services or AWS services than it is to just spin up the equivalent servers and move it over. That's really quite easy. And if you've got production kit, what you don't want to do is two transitions at the same time. You want to do a transition to virtual, and then what you should be doing is a transition to services rather than virtual machines. You don't want to be moving from physical infrastructure to virtual services. There's too much risk involved. So what people do is they'll move to the virtual infrastructure, but like any transformation project, the last bit doesn't get done because something else comes along, or we have another thing to do, or there's a change to that server, or there's a piece of software that means that we just can't do it this week. So that second stage, that move from physical to virtual to a services, is just so hard to plan that often it's the bit that never
happens.
So
is it something that people should just be focusing on the new for? Is that the way that we get past this, so that we're not just sort of migrating legacy into something that's slightly better and slightly cheaper, but we never get round to finishing? If we just focus on the new stuff, if we focus on being able to take new ideas, new services, and put those into properly engineered, properly architected, you know, proper cloud stuff, is that the answer here?
It could well be. I think that's the cleanest way to do it, because you're then building your software, you're developing it to work in those services in that way, rather than to work on your traditional server stack, whether it's virtual or physical. But there are still issues with that, because if you've got an existing platform with your servers, your databases, your connection to your supply chain, your connections to your customer systems, all of these things that are going on, transition to a new set of systems which work in a different way, with different interfaces, with a potentially different data model, is really, really difficult, and not impossible, but you really have to plan for it. It's expensive, and you have to get it right first time. So yeah, absolutely. It does make a lot of sense to build this stuff new, but there's a lot of cost of change, and people need to be prepared for that.
And there's also, of course, a whole bunch of models that will exist within organisations which will be focusing on things like capital investment, on investment cases. And I mean, I've seen this in a number of organisations now, where everything is geared around the idea that an IT project will be expensive and will involve capital expenditure. And so all of the controls around getting projects up and running assume that cost from the get-go, so that they're still going through the financial approval processes that they would have done for a big on-premise server farm, for when they could be just getting up and running with small iterative ideas and being able to circle through the iterations of an idea without having to worry about capital expense up front. But because things are geared around capital projects, it's really hard to find the OPEX money to be able to do experimental, small, agile, iterative stuff without, you know, it then becomes a finance department challenge, and changing the way in which the finance team thinks about it as much as it is about an IT and IT capability challenge.
Well, that's right. And I think if you're doing something like this only to reduce costs in IT or to take advantage of some technology, you're probably missing a real trick, because if your business processes aren't changing and evolving, and if it's not a response to the need to change business processes and respond to customers in a different way, or to work with supply chain in a different way, then it's probably not being done for the right reasons. So re-architecting your business is the time. That's the time when you want to re-architect your IT, not because it happens to be the time when you've got a hardware refresh to do. Yeah, these things need to be joined up.
And it is, I think, very counterintuitive for a lot of people, but I was in a conversation with a bunch of CIOs this week about this very subject, and that the question that was asked by one of them was, has anybody seen success where people have moved to cloud to save cost? And the overwhelming response to it was, they've seen successful projects that have saved cost, but if your starting point is, we are doing this project to save money, they generally don't, or all they do is they push, it's like pushing on a balloon, and it just pushes it out somewhere else.
No, I completely agree with that. Cloud, I've not seen a really good cloud cost justification where it's cheaper. I think you get better service. I think you get better resilience, and you get lots of benefits to your business around less items on your balance sheet weighing you down, less investment in things that can't be changed. So you become more responsive as an organization. There's lots of really good benefits, but it's not going to cost you a massive amount less as far as I've ever seen.
So into the third act of this three-act play, and to think about, how does cloud change the way in which suppliers need to be able to interact with their customers? So we've skipped around a little bit between thinking about software as a service, so people who are providing fully fledged pieces of software that you don't have to worry about any of the issues of things like scaling or architecture, because that's all done for you. And then infrastructure and platform as a service, which is where we're thinking about computing power that can be consumed for your own software. If we think about the way in which software vendors are having to change their business models, I think this is also something where we're still just starting to see, especially for small and medium-sized software vendors, they're only just starting to get their heads around. Because if you're moving from providing software licenses to your customers, and it's up to your customers to be able to run the software themselves, to moving to a model where you are providing a software service delivered in the cloud, it's much more than just an infrastructural change. Now, there's some organisations that I think are starting to get there, and certainly the big ones. I think Microsoft now are starting to show that they do understand and are starting to really now get the idea that cloud-based services are a very different beast to what they've been used to being able to provide. I think some of the really big enterprise companies like Oracle and SAP, to an extent, and many of their clients are so locked into the on-premise software that it doesn't really matter for them. But with small niche vendors, I think it's really challenging, because often they don't have the money or resource to be able to significantly retool what they do as a business. Their clients will be loath to move, but their clients will be seeing overtures from pure cloud vendors. If they're not already in a particular market, they will see them soon. And that kind of relationship is going to be, I think, really challenging. It's an innovator's dilemma thing, again, but where you've got niche, probably industry-specific solutions that are currently delivered to on-premise. And I can think of examples in things like the housing, social housing world. I can think of things in the world of law, where there are specific products that are designed for law firms that are very much on-premise, and that the software vendors aren't really making any moves to be able to move into cloud. And it's those kind of things where it's an industry vertical application that has got a good business turning over on it. It's probably a burden for the customer, and it makes the software vendor actually very ripe for being disrupted in many ways as well. It's more, though, than just saying we're switching from one server model to another. It's a big, big transition that these software companies need to make to become a cloud vendor.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the pure cloud model is pay-as-you-go, isn't it? That this month I want 10 of these, and next month I want 2 of these, and I'm not going to tell you until the day before I want to change. And that is not a model that works very well for suppliers, because they've got to predict their usage. They've got to be able to know what they're going to be providing next month and the next month and the next month. And that's why they don't like to sell those models. They like to sell a service for a year or 2 years. the pay-as-you-go model is rare, actually. And if it's not rare, it's where it's not rare, it's expensive, because people just don't want to sell it. They'd rather you commit it to 12 months, and that's understandable with most business models. It's very hard to find funding where you can't show that you've got income for a certain amount of time. Moving to that pay-as-you-go model and allowing your customers to use the service in that way without a hefty cost penalty is a leap of faith. And I think if you can do those things that, first, say Microsoft and AWS do with their services, if you go and use Azure, native Azure, without using, just taking VirtualBoxes, you'll get better value, but you'll start to use all those features, the backup features and the replication features, all of these things that you can get with pure Azure that are specific to Azure. You can't just take your virtual servers and take them somewhere else. So that's a sort of lock-in that Microsoft, for example, use in Azure. And if software companies can build that lock-in, which they always want to do around their software, and show value in using their software in that way, then over time they can probably show that their retention is better than if they were just holding people to 12-month contracts, which then they didn't feel were doing them any good. It might need a different way of thinking about financing, and a different way of thinking about how you value your business. And I'm not going to hold my breath about that, but I do think it is potentially possible. It's just a matter of how much do customers start pushing that model. Because at the end of the day, companies will move if customers start demanding things in that way, or if competitors turn up with equivalent offers that do allow that flexibility. And as I mentioned last month, I'll come back to the London Underground model. You can buy a ticket for a day, and you can buy a day pass for several zones that will save you money. If you know that you're going to make a certain amount of use, you can save yourself some money by paying more upfront. But customers do keep wanting ways of saving their money and being more flexible. And these days, you can save your money. You can use your Prox card, your credit card to pay for the journeys, and you'll get a better rate because the Underground have managed to cut their costs with regards to how they manage their payments. So people will change that model if it's being demanded. I'm not entirely sure it is being demanded enough at this point for businesses and software suppliers to make that change.
I think that actually the most interesting move in the last couple of years has been from the UK software company Sage. And Sage is a well-established on-premise software company dealing mostly small to mid-sized finance software to companies. They're global. They've got a good global presence. But last year, they announced that they were going into strategic partnership with Salesforce. And so rather than trying to build up their own infrastructure, they've built or in the process of building a set of products on Salesforce. Salesforce is known as a CRM system. To be honest, these days it's much more of a software development platform as it is as a CRM system. And there's a lot of vendors actually who are building their applications as layers on top of Salesforce. And I've seen this in industries like pharmaceuticals, where you've got industry-specific solutions that have been built up on top of the Salesforce service, and actually you barely know that they are Salesforce unless you know that they're Salesforce. That, on the one hand, for me, seems to be a really canny move. On the other, you do just kind of think you're about to get eaten by the big behemoth, because at some point, if it's successful, they'll just consume you. And whilst that might be good for the companies involved, what that will mean long term for the amount of innovation there is going on around that kind of enterprise software level, you do wonder. I mean, you see Oracle buying the likes of NetSuite. The fact that Oracle are a long-term investor in Salesforce themselves, you do start to wonder actually how much of this is going to actually just end up being just like it was before, but with a slightly different architectural model underneath it.
Yeah, we'll go through those cycles, won't we? We'll definitely go through those acquisition and consolidation cycles in various areas of business software, and other contenders will come through. Sage have got a really a brilliant brand really in that space that they inhabit. And hard to know where they go from there. So it makes sense for them to hook up with somebody like Salesforce and take that software into a different delivery model than the, as you say, the on-premise than that it's always been. There will be others coming into that space. There are other small business accounting packages now that which are completely software as a service, and they've been built that way and always have been, with far better charging models than Sage have ever been able to produce. And also Sage have always been a very, they've always been one of these companies that keep their cards very close to their chest technologically. It's very difficult to integrate with Sage software unless you're very well tied in with them. So I think they're doing the right thing, because if you're a small business, with maybe less than 50 employees, it's probably not your first port of call anymore, as it would have been 10, 15 years ago.
And that actually comes down to something I was talking about at an event last week, which is actually a lot of the time your business model, what you need to keep focused on is what is it that you are delivering of value that your customers perceive is the valuable part, not what you think is the valuable part. And actually, maybe what Sage have realized is that they're not in the business of delivering software services. They're in the business of, very much at the top of the application layer, and it's about a brand as well. And that actually we get to a point now where the nature of the way in which the technology is delivered, maybe we'll start seeing tech companies being bought for their brand, not for their technology or their people, which I think would be a new thing.
Yeah, certainly outside the sort of the very early startup world, then that is the case. Software is now sold in terms of acquisition on the basis of its reach and its integration, and I think that's a trend that will continue, and it plays into this whole API economy piece, and how available do you make your data, and how can you share it with other applications and play different tunes on it and take more value from it. So those organizations and those software providers that can do that and can show that they have got those interfaces and can then come all the way back to our initial conversation and play a part in that suite of different applications rather than one monolithic application, probably will do well. Well, a lot of interesting stuff there on cloud economics. Matt, I think we've kicked that one to death. Hopefully it's provided some sort of insight from our various experiences. Now, I know we've got a lot of interesting things that we're working on at the moment, and a lot of really interesting interviews with people that we're going to bring onto the podcast in the next few weeks. So I think everybody should come back next week and see who we've got. I think that would be the best bet. What do you think?
Absolutely. We've got, we're working really hard to be able to line up some interviews with a really diverse group of people, and a diverse bunch of topics. And it's kind of luck of the draw of which ones we get to come off first as to what we'll be doing next week. But some of the things we'll be thinking about use of social networks by CIOs. We're going to be thinking about how to go about inspiring creativity in your organization. We're thinking about doing some stuff around healthcare and technology. And that's just a few of the number that we're planning. So exciting.
Weeks and weeks of this stuff.
Absolutely. And then there'll be a special Christmas edition. I've got no idea
what
the special...
So there will. What a great idea. Definitely. Looking forward to it already.
Absolutely. So with that, I think that's another one done. Congratulations. We've done six.
Excellent.
So that's it. Thanks for joining us next week. As I say, a mystery, but an exciting mystery. If you want to find out more, you can find us at wb40podcast.com. You can follow us on Twitter at wb40podcast. And you can search for us and subscribe to us on iTunes and all other good podcasting platforms. We'll speak to you next week.